Hello, and welcome to the 12th episode of Season 3 of The Dark Money Files, in which we shine a light into a murky world. I am Ray Blake, and with me is my co-host, friend, and business partner, Graham Barrow. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Ray.
So, last time we discussed country risk, which sits at the heart of client risk assessment, and will be at least one of the factors for every bank's approach. We're going to look today at what the other factors are.
Yes, we are. But before we do, Ray, you said there was something you wanted to cover before we get going properly.
Yes, Graham. I think we should address the obvious question here.
And what's that, Ray?
Well, why do we bother assessing client risk in this way? I mean, there's no such thing as no risk, is there?
No, there isn't.
And most banks would say they have no appetite for allowing financial crime.
That is also true.
So given that the bank could find financial crime activity in any client account at all, why bother identifying the higher and lower risk accounts? I mean, I know we've spoken about this before to an extent, but it's clearly a pretty crucial question.
It is, Ray, and it comes down really to resources. No bank can afford, and frankly, nor would they be expected to allocate unlimited resources to detecting and preventing financial crime.
So the upshot of that is that they have to apply their limited resources wisely.
That's right, Ray. And assessing every client's financial crime risk is a key part of that. They can do more extensive checking and have closer oversight of the higher risk client group than the lower risk groups.
Yeah, and we've talked before about how enhanced due diligence will come into play as we look up that risk scale.
Indeed, many of the controls will flex based on the client's risk rating, like the period between regular reviews, possibly transaction monitoring limits, UBO thresholds, and so on.
Makes sense, Graham, but it does tend to cast doubt on the no appetite for financial crime risk appetite statements that we see, doesn't it?
Well, yes, I think it does, Ray. But if you look closely at the statements, banks usually say that they have no appetite for knowingly allowing financial crime. And that's quite an important distinction.
It is. I mean, it means that your compliance and anti-financial crime teams don't have to dwarf the rest of your staff for a start.
Yes. Shame. And it also means that you can't assume that financial crime can only occur in your higher risk accounts.
Yes, I see that. That all really underlines the need to have an effective client risk assessment approach. So let's get on and look at how banks go about it. But it does bring one further issue into play.
And what's that, Ray?
Well, banks tend to assume that their greatest jeopardy lies in their high-risk population.
You might think that's a fair assumption.
Yeah, but only if it's based on an effective risk rating methodology that's being properly applied based on high-quality information.
There are a number of assumptions in that statement, Ray. We should look at them one at a time. So let's start with an effective risk rating. How do you test for that?
Well, in a way, you do exactly what we're talking about now. You have clear and unambiguous risk factors based as far as possible on good quality empirical data that's well aligned to the risks you're measuring. In this case, financial crime risk.
Okay, I get that. Properly applied.
That means testing your different populations against independent criteria. Often that will involve highly experienced operatives applying a risk rating based on experience and judgment, which we don't normally like to rely on, but providing the firm can justify the tag of highly experienced, I think that's okay. The question is where the focus is.
Okay, explain that in a bit more detail.
Well, traditionally, we tend to see most focus on quality assuring the high-risk population. But the worst that might happen here is that a client that doesn't need to be high risk is inadvertently placed in that population.
Yeah, which means more cost to the firm, but definitely not an increased risk.
Exactly. Whereas a client inappropriately placed in a low or medium risk population, when its actual risk is higher, does represent a material risk to the firm, as it will probably have inadequate due diligence and monitoring in place.
So you're saying that firms should be careful to look at their low and medium risk populations when performing their quality assurance to ensure they don't contain, what should we call them, any nasty surprises?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Which means they need to get the stuff we were talking about in the last episode and the stuff we're talking about in this episode absolutely spot on.
Well, if by stuff you mean the various factors involved in correctly assessing the inherent financial crime risk brought to the business by any specific client, Graham, yes, that is what I mean. Shall we move on then?
good plan. As we saw last time, banks will look at a number of client attributes. As I just mentioned, the first set was all about their geography, from which we derive a country risk.
Yeah, we look at where the client lives, her nationality or citizenship, and if the client is a business, where that business operates, the countries it sells to and buys from, and the countries of the people who own it.
Yes, and that talk of business naturally leads to looking at another risk factor.
The actual business activities. We know that some businesses will carry greater risks of financial crime than others, don't we?
Yes, and for different business types, that will mean different aspects of financial crime.
So cash-intensive businesses like restaurants, retail and taxi firms would be prone to money laundering.
Whereas construction, particularly in some parts of the world, is associated with, say, bribery and corruption risks.
While metals manufacturing and chemicals have sanctions risk.
And firms will have their own lists of business types rated typically high, medium or low risk.
And where the business is active in multiple industries, the bank will apply a materiality threshold, then go with the highest risk one, just like they do with country risk, right?
Yeah, that's what usually happens. And where your client is an individual rather than a business, the bank will normally base the industry risk on their occupation.
And in the same way as with country risk, most firms will operate a prohibited industry list, often based on their own specific risk appetite.
I absolutely agree. As an example, the Cooperative Bank here in the UK has a very strict ethical policy, and they will not do business with firms, for example, from adult entertainment market or who are involved in testing on animals or vivisection, and frankly, any other industries that conflict with that ethical stance.
Okay, I've got it. So that's country risk and industry risk. What else is there?
Well, if country risk and industry risk are about means and motive, the next one is more about opportunity.
Ah, so you're talking about product risk then, Graham?
Yes, exactly. You might intend to launder money through your bank, and the industry you work in might give you the means to acquire criminal proceeds that need laundering. But unless you have the right banking products, you won't be able to do anything.
Some products won't help you in this regard. I mean, a personal loan, for instance, doesn't allow you much scope to launder money.
Not much scope, no, but I'd still say some, right?
For example?
Well, suppose the bank requires a guarantor for that loan and they fail to perform adequate KYC on that guarantor.
I get it. So then you default on the loan. The bank turns to the guarantor, by which time it's now out of pocket and highly incentivised to reclaim the money.
And at the point of calling in the guarantee, the bank might have some concerns about the provenance of the funds it's due to receive.
And it's not a good time to find that out, is it?
No, which is why it's always best to do proper due diligence on guarantors prior to commencing a loan arrangement. Although, to be honest, there are much easier ways to launder large sums of money more effectively.
So a current account, for instance, would allow you to send and receive money to and from pretty much anyone, anywhere. I mean, that's likely to be a high-risk product, isn't it?
It certainly is, Ray.
And if you're providing another bank with correspondent banking facilities, or you're providing an import and export company trade finance facilities, that's also going to carry a higher risk.
Absolutely. And you'd also need to look at the combination of product lines the client is using to see if, for instance, there is a possibility to use otherwise low-risk products together to facilitate criminal transfers.
Now that needs quite sophisticated analysis, doesn't it?
Well, it can do, Ray, yes. It's also why an existing client taking up a new type of product should trigger an event-driven review.
Got it. So that's motive, means and opportunity, or country, industry and product risk. Is that it?
Well, depending on how your bank does business, you might also want to look at channel risk.
That refers to how the client accesses your products and services, doesn't it?
It does, Ray, and to how you take on new clients.
Okay, let's start with the new clients angle. For a long time, there's been a requirement to treat non-face-to-face business as higher risk, hasn't there?
Yes, Ray. That was predicated on the fact that identifying the client is less reliable when they're not standing in front of you, for you to compare them with their, say, their ID photograph.
But of course, nowadays, there are increasingly sophisticated electronic ID systems that are actually more reliable than in-person ID&V.
Yes, there are. And the changes from the fifth European Union Anti-Money Laundering Directive recognise this, and they come into force imminently as we record this. But it might take banks' risk assessment methodologies a little while to catch up, I think.
So what are the wider factors in delivery channel risk, Graham?
Well, channels that allow non-face-to-face transactions will still carry more risk on an ongoing basis. If I have to turn up at a branch to organise a transfer, for instance, staff can make sure it's really me and can ask me questions about the purpose of the transaction.
Whereas if it's an internet account, that opportunity to reconfirm identity in person and ask about the purpose doesn't arise. So if I want to launder money, I might well seek to do that laundering through non-face-to-face channels by preference.
Yeah, particularly if you provided your ID and were verified some years ago, when the current rigour may not have been applied quite so consistently.
Yes, I can see how that could be a loophole, because once you've completed ID&V, you never have to do it again with that bank.
Well, that's usually the case in the UK and most other countries, Ray. Yes, although in some jurisdictions you do have to update out-of-date ID documents.
So is that everything then? Country risk, industry risk, product risk and channel risk?
Well, more or less. There's one more which we'll come to in a minute, but let's carry on that basis. The bank, given those, will work out weightings to determine what impact each of those sub-ratings should have on the overall client risk rating. So, for instance, a client with high country risk but low risk on everything else might still come out as medium, say, overall.
And the more high-risk sub-ratings there are, the more likely an overall high-risk rating.
Usually, yes. One thing to bear in mind, though, is that many organisations will have quite a restricted product range, so that different levels of product risk or channel risk may not be possible. So in those banks, product and or channel risk won't necessarily be a factor then in the client risk assessment.
Because it would be the same for every client?
Exactly, right. The banks are not seeking to assess absolute risk, but rather relative risk between different clients to help them apply a risk-based approach.
And on the subject of different clients, that should be factored in as well, shouldn't it, as the last factor?
Yes, it should, Ray. And in fact, we've already spoken about one very special type of client.
Politically exposed persons, or PEPs.
Exactly. But certainly in the case of corporate clients, the entity type of the client will play an important role in determining the risk that the client brings.
Whether it's a publicly quoted company, a private company, a limited liability partnership, or whatever.
Exactly. Different entity types carry very different risks. You only have to look at the various laundromats to determine that. They tend to be full of limited liability partnerships and Scottish limited partnerships and limited companies. But you very rarely see a public limited company or other equivalent publicly quoted entity.
And not to repeat ourselves, we covered all these different entity types in season two.
Yeah, we did, over three separate episodes.
Exactly. One of the things you notice about these factors is that some can't be controlled for, but others can.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you don't have direct control over which country people come from or what entity they've created, but you do over how you offer your products and indeed what products you offer to your clients.
Yeah, but what if the bank's only product or only delivery channel has high risk factors? How does that get reflected? And for that matter, how does a firm with a wide product range assess the relative riskiness of different products?
I think it's the same answer in both cases, Ray. That will come out of the firm-wide financial crime risk assessment. And I think we should take a look at that next time.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Dark Money Files. We hope you enjoyed it. If you would like to listen to future episodes, please subscribe through iTunes, Spotify, or your normal podcast provider. Thanks.